You know, you probably read To Kill a Mockingbird in middle school.
Oh, yeah, pretty much everyone did.
Right. You probably sat at a desk smelling of, like, floor wax and pencil shavings and just accepted that worn paper bag as the ultimate lesson in justice and morality.
Yeah, that was the standard experience.
But what if the book you were handed wasn't a moral compass at all? What if it was rather a carefully constructed mirror designed to reflect only what society wanted to see while keeping us perfectly comfortable?
It completely flips the script on how we consume literature. I mean, if a compass is only useful when it shows you the whole map, we really have to start asking who actually drew that map and, who was purposefully left off the edges of it.
That is the incredibly provocative premise of today's deep dive.
Yeah.
Welcome in, by the way. We are exploring this fascinating essay by Lisa Maxine. She's a writer, an educator, and an applied psychologist.
And her brand is super interesting too.
It really is. If you're familiar with it, her logo is Lisa Maxine Writes, and it features this striking visual of a glowing book and a golden quill with faces slowly emerging from the shadows.
Right. It's a very literal representation of bringing silenced voices into the light.
Yeah, and her essay does exactly that. The mission of this deep dive today is to unpack how narrative perspective shapes our understanding of history, justice, and trauma.
Because she asks one brilliant foundational question. Would To Kill a Mockingbird still be considered a classic if it were told from the perspective of Tom Robinson's daughter?
It's such a massive question.
It is, because she isn't just reviewing a book here. She is using her background in applied psychology to really challenge those deeply held assumptions you or I might have about what actually makes a story a classic in the American canon.
But before we even crack open the text of the novel itself, Maxine argues that we have to dismantle the pedestal the book sits on.
Yeah, we have to look at the real-world contradictions surrounding its legacy first.
Right. And she traces this back to her time in graduate school studying mental health counseling, where she started looking at concepts like cultural competence and aversive racism.
Which is a crucial psychological mechanism to understand here, because aversive racism isn't that overt, hostile bigotry we usually picture.
Right, it's more subtle.
Exactly. It's a concept detailing how people who consciously believe they are egalitarian and fair-minded can still, unconsciously harbor and perpetuate deep-seated biases.
Wow.
Yeah, they might avoid interactions with other races or unwittingly uphold systems that disadvantage them, all while genuinely believing they're the good guys.
Right, and Maxine's professors encouraged her to apply that exact lens to the media we celebrate.
To look at a narrative and ask whose voice is being centered here and whose comfort is being protected.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because she applies that lens to the label of classic, and she argues the word is often used as a shield.
Yeah.
In her view, calling something a classic is just society's way of declaring it untouchable. It becomes protected from critique. But the most staggering part of her essay, I think, is how she illustrates this with a real-world example from Monroeville, Alabama.
Harper Lee's hometown.
Right. She brings in Bryan Stevenson, the incredible attorney and author of Just Mercy. In the movie, based on his career, he drives into Monroeville, and a courthouse clerk excitedly urges him to visit the museum so he can stand right where Atticus Finch once stood.
What's fascinating here is the sheer surreal irony of that moment.
It's wild.
Monroeville has entirely built its civic identity around lionizing a fictional white lawyer for defending a black man. But in that very same real-world courthouse, an actual black man named Walter McMillian was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death.
Let me try to map this out because it's almost hard to wrap your head around.
It really is.
It's like a town building a massive, multi-million-dollar theme park dedicated to a fictional superhero who saves the city.
Complete with statues and tours.
Yeah, guided tours and everything, while simultaneously actively ignoring real-world victims who are crying for help right outside the park gates.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. And from a sociological standpoint, Maxine argues this reveals our societal priorities.
We protect the mythology.
Right. We protect the fantasy of white heroism and neatly packaged moral lessons much more fiercely than we protect the living, breathing black men who are still trapped by the exact same injustices the book claims to expose.
The comfortable fiction is simply easier to digest.
Way easier than the real-world tragedy, yeah.
So keeping that real-world need for comfortable fiction in mind, that explains exactly why a character like Atticus Finch was engineered the way he was.
Maxine takes us right into the pages of the novel to look at that.
Yeah, she looks at how the author's choices created these massive blind spots, starting with Atticus himself. I mean, for decades, he's been the gold standard of morality.
Oh, absolutely. But her essay reframes him entirely. She points out that the reality of the narrative is quite different from the myth.
How so?
Well, Atticus takes on a hopeless case, fully aware he cannot win with an all-white jury in 1930s Alabama. Maxine argues that, within the mechanics of the story, he is taking the case largely to preserve his own moral reputation in the town.
Interesting.
In her view, he functions as a white savior figure who protects white comfort. Meanwhile, the actual black pain, like the life of Tom Robinson, is just pushed into the background as a plot device.
I have to pause and push back just a little bit here, because the phrase white savior can instantly make people defensive.
Oh, for sure.
I can hear listeners thinking, wait, it sounds like she's attacking a character who is at least trying to have good intentions. He didn't have to take the case at all. Doesn't intention matter?
That's an important question, and Maxine actually anticipates that exact defensiveness in her psychological framing.
She does.
Yeah. The term white savior unsettles people precisely because it disrupts a very comforting fantasy we all like to hold on to.
The idea that good intentions are enough.
Exactly. The idea that good intentions can absolve unequal outcomes. But Maxine's argument is that intention doesn't change the structural reality of the novel.
Because Atticus gets to walk away feeling morally upright.
Right. And his children learn a valuable lesson about empathy, but at the end of the day, Tom Robinson still dies.
So the critique isn't saying Atticus is evil.
No, not at all. It's pointing out that the narrative uses him to center white moral development rather than prioritizing black survival.
And that centering is magnified tenfold by the narrator, Scout.
Oh, massively.
She is a 6 to 8 year old white child. Because we see this brutal systemic racism through her innocent nostalgic perspective, the blow is drastically softened.
It gives white readers a gentle, safe way to explore racism without ever feeling directly implicated or threatened.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the actual victims of the story, Tom Robinson and his wife Helen, are practically erased. Tom is just reduced to a symbol in a courtroom, and Helen is silenced almost entirely.
Which brings us to the reimagining at the heart of the essay. Maxine asks you to imagine if the story wasn't filtered through Scout's safe lens.
What if it was told by Tom Robinson's daughter?
Right. Maxine names her Faith. And Faith is the exact same age as Scout, but her vantage point is worlds apart.
Because Scout gets to tell her story from the safety of her father's respected name, but Faith has to tell her story from the shadows.
Maxine writes this incredibly visceral, imagined diary for Faith, and the lived experience she describes is just heartbreaking.
Faith doesn't have the luxury of childhood innocence.
No, she wakes up to fear every single day. She walks to a dilapidated school where the books are falling apart.
And they still have the names of the white kids from across town scribbled inside them.
Yeah, and her daily commute to that school involves being called the N-word by those same white children.
Oh, wow.
She hears the adults in her community whispering the word rape. And even though she's too young to fully comprehend the legal mechanics of it, she feels the sheer terror of what that accusation means for her family.
She lives with the constant looming threat of a lynch mob showing up at their door in the middle of the night.
Exactly.
And here's where it gets really interesting and just absolutely devastating. Think about the climax of the story.
Right, when Tom Robinson is killed.
The official story handed down to the town is that he was shot 17 times by guards because he was trying to climb a fence to escape.
But Faith knows this is a complete biological lie. Because her father's arm had been caught in a cotton gin and rendered completely useless since childhood.
He physically could not have climbed a fence if his life depended on it.
That specific detail shifts the entire genre of the book.
It really does.
For Scout, the trial and its aftermath are a confusing, tragic loss of innocence. But for Faith, it is the systematic, intentional murder of a loving father.
Covered up by a flimsy lie.
A lie that the entire town, including the so-called heroes, simply accepts. When you force yourself to read the events from Faith's perspective, the warmth and nostalgia of Monroeville completely evaporate.
You are no longer reading a coming-of-age story. You are reading a horror story about unsoftened systemic cruelty.
Exactly.
So we take this unsoftened reality, and then we look at how this narrative imbalance plays out in the real world today.
Mm-hmm.
Because Maxine transitions us into the modern middle school classroom.
Right, where Scout's safe perspective is assigned to students year after year.
And she points out that when people critique the continued use of this book, educators often mount an incredibly fierce resistance.
They do, and psychology provides a clear mechanism for why that happens. It's a concept called identity protection.
Identity protection, how does that work?
Well, when a teacher has built their lesson plans around this book for decades, using it as their primary tool to teach empathy, they fuse the book's value with their own professional and moral identity.
Oh, I see.
So when an essay like Maxine's challenges the book, the teacher unconsciously experiences it not as a critique of a curriculum, but as a direct attack on their own goodness.
The brain reacts as if its core identity is under threat. And the defense that always comes out of that identity protection is, well, education isn't meant to be comfortable. We have to teach the hard history.
But Maxine points out a massive flaw in that logic. It completely ignores power dynamics and consent.
Because she draws a sharp line between productive discomfort and compulsory emotional labor.
Yes. Productive discomfort is what a white student might feel when learning about the history of racism from a safe historical distance. It's challenging, but it's an intellectual exercise.
Right.
Compulsory emotional labor is what is forced upon a black student whose own history and communal trauma are being put on display, analyzed, and debated by their peers.
Entirely without their consent.
Exactly.
To really drive this home, Maxine offers a thought experiment that honestly stopped me in my
That's
tracks.
a powerful one.
She says, imagine a book that contained a degrading, violent slur aimed at white people, and it was printed 50 times in the text. Now imagine a teacher standing at the front of the room, reading that word aloud, line by line, to a class of 30 students where only five are white, and the teacher defends it as a necessary history lesson.
It would never, ever happen.
Never.
The book would be banned by the school board by the end of the week. Parents would riot, and administrators would intervene immediately because society instinctively understands that those five white students would be experiencing a hostile environment aimed directly at their identity.
But when we reverse the scenario, when a slur about black people is read aloud from To Kill a Mockingbird in a room where only five out of 30 students are black, those five students are expected to just sit quietly.
They are told to absorb it for the sake of literature.
And if they express discomfort, their discomfort is treated as a disruption to the lesson.
The hidden lesson functioning beneath the official curriculum there is profound. Maxine argues it teaches the entire classroom that some students' dignity is assumed and protected by default, while other students' endurance of harm is just the expected baseline.
Now, people will defend reading the slur by saying, oh, but black students use that word in the hallways all the time.
And Maxine shuts that defense down completely.
She explains that the people who taught them to survive, their mothers, their grandmothers, they don't use it casually.
Right. In the context of black families, the word is guarded, it's highly contextual, and it carries the history of a warning.
Maxine states very clearly, historical trauma is not a teaching tool for a middle school classroom.
It just isn't.
So what does this all mean? If Maxine is arguing that teaching this book causes active, unequal harm in a middle school setting, is she saying the solution is to just ban it entirely?
No.
Like, do we pull it from the shelves and pretend the ugly parts of history didn't happen?
No, and she is very explicit that she's not advocating for censorship. This isn't about hiding from history. It's about a concept she calls care. It's about educators paying attention to how lessons land in unequal bodies. Her argument is that middle schoolers simply do not have the developmental maturity or the historical framework to carry the psychological weight of 1930s Alabama without it causing that unequal harm.
So if middle school is the wrong environment because they lack the tools, where does this book belong? How do we actually hold it accountable instead of just tossing it out?
Maxine argues it belongs in an AP history or AP English class.
Oh, that makes sense.
You need an environment where older students possess the critical analytical tools to actually grapple with the book's blind spots. They need to be able to dissect its racial language and its white savior framing rather than just consuming it as a simple, unquestioned moral fable.
I love how she actually scripts out an imagined dialogue for an AP African American history class to show what this looks like in practice.
It really brings it to life.
Because the students in her scenario aren't just passively accepting the text, they're actively pushing back. One student points out how exhausting it is that the only representation of black life they ever get in classic literature is inextricably tied to oppression, false accusations, and incarceration.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Maxine is drawing on some heavy-hitting educational theorists to explain why that exhaustion matters.
Like who?
Well, she brings in Dr. Gloria Letts in Billings, who warns about the danger of deficit-based narratives.
Deficit-based narrative.
Yeah, a deficit-based narrative is what happens when a curriculum consistently defines a marginalized group only by what they lack or the trauma they suffer, rather than their agency or joy.
Right. And when you do that year after year, it subtly normalizes Black disposability in the minds of all the students.
Exactly.
And she also references the feminist scholar Bell Hooks in this section, right?
Yes. She uses Bell Hooks to explain the phenomenon of consuming Black experiences and Black pain strictly for the moral education of white audiences. Without the right framework, the classroom basically becomes a stage for voyeurism. The white students get a neatly packaged, teachable moment about tolerance. But the intense emotional toll on the Black students sitting right next to them is entirely ignored.
In this imagined AP class, the students also start connecting the fictional Tom Robinson to real historical and modern figures.
Right. They mention Emmett Till and the Scottsboro Boys.
But they don't leave it in the past. They bring it right up to the present, connecting it to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Trayvon Martin.
Which is exactly the kind of critical thinking the book should provoke. The students in Maxine's dialogue realize that teaching the book uncritically as a classic actually sanitizes modern racism.
Because it allows society to point at the 1930s and say, look how bad things used to be.
Safely locking the injustice in the past. It provides an excuse to avoid confronting how those exact same systemic biases operate in the justice system today.
And the teacher in this imagined AP class perfectly contextualizes it by noting that To Kill a Mockingbird became a classic through the exact same institutional machinery that canonized things like Gone with the Wind and The Birth of a Nation.
It was elevated by a society that valued a very specific narrative.
Which brings the entire essay full circle to answer the question posed by her title.
Right.
After unpacking the real-world ironies of Monroeville, the deliberate erasure of Faith Robinson, the classroom trauma mask as education, and the defensive shield of the white savior complex, Maxine has the answer. Does she still think To Kill a Mockingbird is a classic?
And her answer is yes, but she completely redefines what that word means.
She argues that decolonizing our education system doesn't mean you just throw literature in the trash. It means you hold it accountable.
Exactly. You don't keep using a standard practice just because of tradition. Classic, in her redefined view, does not mean exemplary. It means representative.
Representative.
It is a classic because it perfectly, flawlessly represents an America that is infinitely more comfortable with white moral awakening than it is with Black humanity.
It represents a culture that prefers stories that feel manageable, nostalgic, and safe over stories that tell the full, unvarnished truth.
That brings us to her final defining quote of the essay, which I think summarizes the whole mission. She writes, "So I don't reject the label classic. I reject the lie we attach to it."
Man, that is powerful.
It is such a powerful paradigm-shifting distinction. It forces you to stop treating the book as an unquestionable moral instructional manual and start treating it as a historical artifact.
An artifact that reveals just as much about the biases of the culture that celebrated it as it does about the era it describes.
Exactly.
It really changes everything about how you view the media you consume.
It absolutely does.
We've covered a massive amount of ground today. We started by looking at the real-world irony of Monroeville, Alabama, building a theme park to a fictional lawyer, while a real Black man suffered in the very same courthouse. We stepped into the heartbreaking imagined diary of Faith Robinson, who knew the biological truth about her father's useless arm while the town accepted a lie.
Yeah.
And we examined the modern double standards of middle school classrooms, where marginalized students are expected to silently absorb slurs under the guise of productive discomfort.
We've unpacked the psychological mechanisms of aversive racism and identity protection, seeing how the white savior narrative protects the comfort of the reader while silencing the very people the story is supposedly trying to save.
So as you go about your day, whether you're reading a celebrated novel, watching a critically acclaimed movie, or even navigating standard practices and traditions in your professional life, I want you to ask yourself the question Lisa Maxine's professors asked her, whose voice is being centered here? And whose comfort is being protected.
And to take that one step further, I want to leave you with this final thought. We just saw how shifting the narrator from Scout to Faith completely unravels the moral triumph of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, it exposes the blind spots we were actively taught to ignore.
So what other foundational American stories, what major historical events, or even what legendary success stories in your own workplace would completely collapse if they were suddenly told from the perspective of the people who were forced into the background?
Something to really think about.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.